Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Yuck, yuck, yucking it up here at Heritage Radio Network. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. So we all know water is big on the national consciousness right now. We're all talking about the Flint, Michigan situation. But actually, Des Moines, the city of Des Moines in Iowa, has been dealing with their own water quality issues for low these many months. And to talk about that issue today with us is Bill Stowe, the CEO and general manager of the Des Moines Water Works. Bill sits on the board of directors of the Association of Metropolitan Water Agencies, representing the largest drinking water utilities in North America. He is a member of the American Society of Civil Engineers and a member of the Iowa Bar Association. He frequently acts through the American Arbitration Association as an impartial arbitrator in resolving complex construction and commercial disputes involving public and private construction projects. Welcome to the program, Bill. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Well, yeah, I just turned the microphone on like I couldn't actually hear my headphones before. So I'm glad you're there.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, Bill, let me ask you this. How many people have you, why aren't you on television all over the place? I mean, you should be like part of this
general
discussion.
Maybe I'm not very photogenic, Katie. I have a perfect face for radio. I think that's probably it. We certainly, you know, we do get a lot of media attention, but realistically, there's a lot of headwind coming into us also from the forces of industrial ag.
Oh, well, we're going to be talking about that, Bill. But let's start by explaining to people, like, in case they haven't been following this story, because it's really been over a year now that I certainly have had this on my radar. And I've done a couple stories with Tom Philpott about it. I'm sure you know him quite well. So the upshot is that Des Moines has been, has problematic water quality. And in order to sort of address that issue, you have resorted to the expedience of the solution of filing a lawsuit against three upriver counties of Des Moines for their water pollution. Can you talk to us a little bit about what your suit addresses and what you're hoping for in the outcome?
Sure. Let me give you a little context.
Yes, please.
If you haven't erased all of your memory banks about the Iowa caucuses just a week ago in the presidential selection process, we're the capital city of Iowa. We serve about 500,000 customers here in the middle of the state.
Right.
Most of our customers are residential, but we have a little industry, commercial businesses. But we're a surface water provider, so we draw our water not from deep wells or the aquifers, a couple thousand feet beneath the ground in groundwater. We use surface water. We draw from rivers, and rivers are largely kind of captive to land practices upstream within the watershed. And in Iowa, upstream in the watershed means overwhelmingly agricultural practices. Our watersheds are about 10,000 square miles, but heavily industrial ag, 90% or so of the surface areas and some kind of agricultural activity upstream from us. We have seen for the last 25 years or so serious problems with nitrate concentrations.
Right.
Nitrate, as the name implies, is a form of nitrogen. Nitrogen is a fertilizer that's very important in industrial agriculture to keep corn and soybeans in particular well fertilized, but it's also a pollutant that travels easily with the water into the surface waters, and hence our business downstream from large agricultural row crop providers and also animal feeding operations, which have nitrogen in the manure that they use for farm applications coming out of the livestock operations, cause serious problems for us in keeping our drinking water safe for our 500,000 customers. So About a year ago, as you mentioned, we went through the process of first, under the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act, warning three counties upstream and their boards of supervisors, who are elective positions that manage really kind of a stormwater utility. Our farmland has to be drained, and underneath, if you can imagine, about 3 or 4 feet underneath our beautiful, rich topsoil, there are drainage tiles. There are systems to move water away from the soil, move it laterally as opposed to letting it going down as water necessarily does, vertically. Instead of gravity, it's being shot over to the side into the waters of the state, heavily polluted, and a lot more water than if they were not drained. We warned the county supervisors and three counties upstream about a year ago that we would sue if they wouldn't come to grips with their environmental adverse environmental impacts from these drainage districts, and they basically told us to take a walk. So we filed a suit in federal district court in the Northern District of Iowa under the Clean Water Act, listed our concerns about them being point source polluters, and we'll talk more about that, I'm sure.
Yes, we will.
And then also sued under a number of state law claims, basically saying that under the Iowa Constitution and Iowa law generally, the waters of the state are a commonwealth, and they are fouling the commonwealth by dumping directly into our surface waters without any regulation. So it's been an interesting ride. We're scheduled for hearing on those issues in August of this year, and are going through what the lawyers talk about as discovery or motion practice right now, a lot of exchange of information and better kind of focusing on the specific issues as we approach trial.
It's just an incredible story to me. So are you able to identify which farms or which entities are most responsible for the pollution, or is it because it goes into this sort of tile district, it's sort of not possible to really say, oh, it's the, you know, it's the Smith & Company CAFO over here that's doing it, or it's the, you know, the great big corn farm over there? Is it because those waters are aggregated that you can't actually go after the you know, the real polluter, or is it just so widespread and generalized that you might as well sue the counties?
Well, it's a little bit like a stormwater system in a city or a small town where the pipes come off the street and drain the street. What we are doing is we're looking at the aggregation point, that is the point of discharge in the drainage district, and saying that's point source polluter, and the people who contribute to that are the benefited area. So in our case, we're suing about a dozen drainage districts that are behind those drainage districts are identifiable farms, but we're suing the elective county officials that we think should be overseeing those drainage districts, not just to get water off the land, which is their argument, but we think they're also responsible for the downstream impacts. And so it was never our approach to try and go to individual farmers and sue them. The approach here really is to go after the public utility and the public office holders who we think have a responsibility that they've shrugged off here. Certainly, if we're successful in our argument that those drainage districts should each be permitted and regulated, that'll have an impact on individual farmers. But our approach is to go for the public utilities and the publicly elected officers, recognizing that behind them are obviously large ag providers.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I think that's... You definitely want to make this sort of the elected official more culpable than, because, I mean, the farmers would just pay a fine and keep on going, right? I mean, if it were them, would they
have
to actually address the...
Well, that's our concern. We really are looking for long-term solutions here, not flash-in-the-pan things. Mm-hmm. We've seen enough flash-in-the-pan solutions from the USDA and from state government, where a lot of billions of dollars have been poured into this state that essentially subsidizes agriculture, and in theory, they were supposed to promote environmental practices, but they haven't. So we're tired of that approach. We want individual responsibility and accountability that's long-lasting, not just throwing a bunch of public money at a problem that really only makes the problem worse. That's what we've seen in our federal farm programs, in our view.
Wow, that's really interesting, Bill. We're going to have to go back to that. I noticed, I did quite a bit of homework for this interview, and you were saying that the primary problems are the nitrates that are coming down from fertilizer and manure. And I looked at the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey website, which your website directs people to, and it showed the nitrate and nitrite levels recorded at nearly 12 or 11.9. I don't know if it's a percentage or parts per million or whatever.
The parts per million, milligrams per liter, parts per million, right. Absolutely. And the lawful level is 10.
That's right.
So even now in the winter, and I'm speaking to you in the middle of a quasi-blizzard here, even in this kind of weather where obviously no crops are out there and there's no one fertilizing or putting, hopefully, manure on the soils now,
right.
We still have a significant problem here. Fortunately, we have enough denitrification that we can work with 11 and 12 even in February, but it's an indication of a larger problem. When you have those kind of numbers this time of year, imagine
right.
what that'll look like in May and June, which is the height of our growing season here,
sure.
where there'll be a number of concerns about too much fertilizer and too little crop on uptake.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I just thought that was amazing. I mean, I'm sure your numbers soar right off the chart. It must be like 15, 16, 20 parts per million when you get into that part of the growing season. So that's pretty scary. And nitrates, you know, cause a variety of health problems. But I guess what I wanted to ask about that was, well, never mind. I forgot what I wanted to ask. But now I want to ask you, why does it cost you so much to clean the water? I mean, you just mentioned denitrification. You know, are there other things that you want to clean out as well as nitrates, or is that the main problem? Tell us a little
Absolutely.
Bit more about
I mean,
what else is in there.
We've been doing this cleaning water for our customers since really about the Civil War, Katie, and in this part of the world, you know, we're really very comfortable with how you deal with some of the things that you think about in safe drinking water, mm-hmm. microbiological problems as an example, and suspended soils and all the kind of things, viruses and bacteria and
Absolutely.
Algae that are part of cleaning surface water. Taking nitrates out is a whole different process. We've had to build a side stream process, a denitrification process. We have the largest denitrification process in the world. That's kind of like arguing I'm the best chain smoker at a party. Not exactly something you want to brag about, but it's still a fact. We have this very expensive system that is out there. It was built 25 years ago when the problem wasn't as bad as it is now. And so we're reaching the regular life cycle, the point where a 25-year-old facility is running out and we're seeing a worse problem. So we, like a lot of water utilities, are looking at spending a whole lot of money to upgrade it. But the basic system that we and most water utilities use in the United States, something called lime softening, and it does really well at getting things out of the water up to a point, and the point for us is nitrate concentrations. It does not deal well with that kind of issue, and to use a different analogy, there are things like lead that aren't dealt well with through the kind of basic process that we and other folks have, and so you have to come up with a side stream process. Because of the industrial ag pollutants in this state, this side stream process of denitrification is incredibly expensive. And you touched on it just a second ago in your questions. Not denitrifying, having too much nitrate concentrations in drinking water is a serious and fatal risk for infants.
Yeah.
And for the rest of us, there's emerging research now that talks about vulnerabilities of immune systems and nitrate concerns for all of us, but it is a huge concern for the very young, and we're, as the capital city and kind of the regional center of medicine in this state, you know, we have a number of hospitals with neonatal units as an example. Our inability to provide them low nitrate concentrations in water creates huge commercial issues for them, where they have to have their own neonatal units to be able to further clean the water that we provide them. Just huge consequences from a public health standpoint and from a business standpoint. So we're very concerned at the root of this issue, no pun intended, that industrial ag is pushing a cost of production and a public health risk to our consumers, and that's something we're no longer able to tolerate.
Yes, sure. I totally understand. Just to kind of give a little bit of history. So would you say that this, because you're saying that your water quality, your water cleaning system, your denitrification system came online around 25 years ago. And was that around the same time that concentrated area feeding operations began in the hog business? Because that seems to me around when that began to consolidate as an industry. So would you say that that sort of tipped the scales, or is it just the increasing amount of land that is under cultivation for corn and soy, which leads to a lot of fertilizer use? Or is it
an unholy trio? Of factors that come into play, the green revolution, the change in agricultural practices and industrial farming, where it took more addition of nutrients, particularly nitrogen, into the soils to make the new genetically engineered corn crops in particular, but also other row crops, viable, happened, you know, in the 70s. Certainly, animal feeding operations have become huge business in this state. I'm talking to you from a state that has 3 million people and 21 million hogs.
Yes.
What do we focus on in terms of making sure every drop of sewage is treated and permitted and handled correctly, the 3 million? What do we ignore, the 21 million?
That's right.
Part of the problem, that we have a huge water issue here, but there are improvements in drainage systems. There is a different ethic about the use of not only manure from animal feeding operations, but anhydrous ammonia for nitrogen sources. And, you know, realistically, more and more land in cultivation in a state that is unrecognizable for what it looked like 100 years ago. Obviously, this is a factory farm state.
Yeah.
And so if you go out and drive the state, you're going to see, you know, hundreds and thousands of acres in row crops, where the economics now force an industrial kind of ethic that has more and more chemicals or manure being used on those soils and less rotation.
Right.
This is pretty much a corn and soybean state.
Yeah.
40 years ago, you would see smaller grains, oats. We have a growing ag movement for local foods groups and for organic groups and CSAs that are beginning to turn that around in areas around the metropolitan areas like the one I'm talking to you about. But the state is largely still, in our watersheds, 10,000 square miles of plowed and CAFO'd soils. And that's certainly created a problem for us in the last 40 years or so.
I'm going to cry, man. That is like just the saddest story I've ever heard. I mean, really, Iowa just is heartbreaking. I should tell you, Bill, that I was in Iowa not too long ago. I think it was over the summer. I was there for some conference or other, which I can't remember. But I was absolutely overwhelmed by the reek of the water in the river. I mean, I was staying quite near it, and I walked across the river. I went to some sort of crazy little Hispanic festival or something. And the smell of the water, especially at night, was like, you know, indescribably bad. I mean, it was this horrible combination of chemical smell and manure smell. And I said to the woman as I was checking out of the hotel, "How do you drink this water? Like, I wouldn't touch it." She said, "Oh, drink the water? Don't be silly. I mean, I didn't even want to shower in it." So it's, I totally get what you're dealing with there. It's terrifying.
You know, the in a state like this that is so dominated by industrial agriculture, our surface waters are horrible.
Yeah.
You look at them and they're brown.
Yes.
They're brown because of suspended soils as much as anything. But
sure,
when we have a rain event, we're seeing foam, which is a biological activity from manure and from human waste as well as animal waste. That's a horrible process. But we're reliant on taking that surface water and making it drinking water, and we can do that safely and with some aesthetics, but nonetheless, it's really expensive and it's a risk. We're seeing the kind of nitrate concentrations that lead us to the conclusion that safely treating it and economically treating it is increasingly becoming a situation that we're risking not being able to do on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. It certainly sounds like it to me. Let's talk for a second about that point non-point source argument, because a lot of these agricultural entities are using that, you know, well, we're not a point source, in order to shift their responsibility for pollution off of their shoulders and onto just, I don't know, who's the citizens? I mean, like, I don't know how they get away with that, but how does that point non-source argument or non-point source argument work for them?
Yeah, basically what the argument from Industrial Ag is that it's a farm runoff that mm-hmm. that contributes along with sewage treatment plants and your yard and my yard and regular soil activities to the pollutant levels we have in our rivers. Well, we have chosen a path here that goes directly to point source polluters. That is, remember, underneath our farmland is a plumbing system, and the plumbing system's a series of pipes, and that pipe is a point. There's an exemption under the Clean Water Act that talks about agricultural stormwater discharge being exempt from regulation. Well, our argument is that this isn't agricultural stormwater discharge when it comes out of a pipe. It's groundwater, and it is clearly a point source. None of our regulators have required permits at either the state level or the federal level for those kind of point source polluters into the water, this waters of the state. But no other business in this state, if you have a paint factory or a sewage treatment facility or a city's municipal storm sewer system that collects rainwater, you can't take a pipe discharge into the waters of the state without a permit. Uh-huh. Agriculture, however, does and will, at least in their mind, do that forever. And we've got a lot of science, including even what the Republican governor here and the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture have agreed to. The Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy says that 90% of the nutrient problem is from agriculture. Mm-hmm. We regulate 10% and leave 90% unregulated, and wonder why it gets worse and worse mm-hmm. for that very reason. Yeah. We're not coming to grips with the fundamental problem, and that's agricultural accountability for environmental degradation in the state.
And that speaks to the political clout, I guess, that these agricultural entities have in terms of...
Absolutely. If you watched any of the presidential selection process here, one of the outcomes that was a little surprising to some is that one of the candidates didn't kiss the ring of corporate ag and the renewable fuel standard and
yeah.
the use of ethanol as a major subsidy to prop it up in our economy. Industrial Ag and the Iowa Farm Bureau in particular are extraordinarily important forces in our legislature and our governor's mansion. No matter which party we're talking about, they are extraordinary forces, the single most important and effective forces in our political process, and certainly the presidential selection process shows that one way or another. But the reality is this: we only have 90 or so thousand farms and farmers left in this state, in a state of 3 million folks. The demographic is changing, and the tolerance for pushing that cost of production and that health risk to consumers generally in the state now is being recalibrated. I'm confident that if we're not successful in our lawsuit, there'll be a substantial political pushback eventually that'll have us doing environmental protection in a way it should be without regard to what the consequences are on industrial agriculture.
Oh, how interesting. I can't wait to see that play out. I have one more question, then we're going to go to break for a second, and then we'll be right back. But I noticed, speaking of your governor, that Governor Branstad had proposed a sales tax to deal with the water quality problems. And I guess my question was, is like, talk about throwing us, not even a question, but talk about throwing a sop to the ag community. It's like a sales tax. Why should everyone else have to pay for this, you know, for the agricultural pollution, which you can evidently back up with science? Did you want to comment on that? On that particular proposal?
You know, I'd be happy to. It's we think the same way. Fundamental in our view to getting our hands around this problem is having the polluters pay, having monitoring and measuring and public data out there to make sure that there's compliance with permitting requirement, and having accountability.
Yeah.
The accountability should go to the producers. Sales tax will fall heavily on my consumers, the
sure.
people who I sell water to. Agricultural sales tax exemptions are way too thick in this state. Much of the ag community is exempt from any sales tax. And so it really is a situation where the governor is suggesting that our consumers can pay again by subsidizing corporate ag, and even worse,
and drink foul water.
There's a competition with public schools for that sales tax money, who need that for their own infrastructure. So it's a pretty cynical ploy, in our view, to again keep the burden on our customers without recognizing the real problem, and that's that the polluters need to pay to clean up, just as pick at U.S. Steel or Con Ed or anybody who discharges into the air pollutants need to be held accountable to clean up the pollutants. So do industrial agricultural point source polluters who discharge into the waters of the state.
Absolutely. Well, stay on the line. We're going to be right back with Bill Stowe, the guy who's fighting the good fight for clean water in Des Moines. We'll be right back after this station break, and we'll learn more about what they're doing.
And you're listening to a song called Better All the Time by a band named Zuli. We will be right back on What Doesn't Kill You.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm talking today about Des Moines with Bill Stowe, the CEO and general manager of the Des Moines Water Works. And while Des Moines has not occupied the same shocking place in American American media as Flint has, they've been dealing with their very own problems that are perhaps not identical, but certainly of concern to more than one community around the nation. Because this problem, I am sure, which is pollution coming from upriver counties, agricultural counties, is not unique to Des Moines. So actually, in speaking to that, I wanted to get sort of into sort of a more of a macro look at your problem, because surely you are not the only city that deals with this kind of problem. And do you see yourself as being sort of a spear leader or spearhead in trying to make agriculture be a little more accountable in terms of their pollution?
No question about it, Katie, that we are somewhat unique because of the intensity of farming and the intensity of the drainage systems that we talked about before the break. But ultimately, whether you're in Iowa or Illinois or Indiana,
Ohio,
as an example, in the upper portions of the Mississippi Valley, we are the main contributors to the dead zone, to the hypoxic area of the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so certainly the issues that we are facing here are not just issues for us in Des Moines, Iowa, but they're issues that really go to the heart of surface water pollution in this country, and particularly in the Mississippi Valley, the states that have really closed their eyes to their responsibility for downstream adverse environmental impacts, particularly in the lower Mississippi area.
It's really, it just is really incredible. And just the kerfuffle over WOTUS, the Waters of the United States, and how many members of Congress voted to, get rid of that. And then that had to be vetoed by the president because it was, clearly in the interests of the population, but not in the interests of their campaign contributions. I mean, these stories are just mind-blowing to me. I wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which really struck me, and that was about when you talked about the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, who's of course former governor for Iowa, and your governor Branstad, about the nutrient reduction strategy and how that evolved and the fact that it was voluntary. Let's talk a little bit about that voluntary idea. Since when has that ever worked?
That is the great irony, isn't it, that we would rely on a voluntary system for public health protection, and that's exactly, unfortunately, what happens in Iowa. The nutrient reduction strategy in Iowa and in all of the Mississippi states, the Mississippi watershed states, were triggered because of the concern about hypoxia. And so the US EPA now, about 15 years ago, asked the states to come up with individual strategies for how they would deal with their contribution to pollution, nutrient pollution in particular, into the Mississippi River. Well, our state, under the leadership of Republican Governor Branstad and the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship and our main regulators, that is the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and Iowa State University, a land-grant school here with huge industrial agricultural ties, through a long process announced about 3 years ago what they termed the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which really has some great science to it, and the science basically comes down to this. Rather, it's nitrogen, which we are talking about today as in our nitrate pollution problem, or it's phosphorus, which is another nutrient that really is responsible traveling with the soils for things like algal blooms, like we saw in Lake Erie, that triggered loss of drinking water for the city of Toledo. Agriculture is 90% of that problem. And then the other 10% are point source polluters that are regulated, like we talked about before, sewage treatment plants, municipal storm sewer systems, factories that discharge their effluent into the waters of the United States. They're heavily regulated. The 90% isn't. The conscious outcome of the science was that Iowa should continue to toe the line on a voluntary environmental protection program, a series of conservation practices that farmers can use voluntarily to reduce nutrient pollution. Obviously, that's a ridiculous premise that we can protect public health and the environment through a voluntary process. I don't voluntarily have a catalytic converter on my vehicle. We have a national policy to protect air of this country by compelling me appropriately to have that. Yeah. I doubt that I would volunteer to do that, but yet we seem to believe that farmers will volunteer to use less nutrients to have a better crop rotation or whatever conservation practices to ensure the health and public safety for those of us downstream. Well, that's not working. In the 3 years since this nutrient reduction strategy has been released, we've seen our highest levels of nitrogen on both rivers at the same time. Last year, we ran our denitrification process half the time, 177 days to be precise. Wow. And it's just not working. We've had more beach closures, more impaired waterways, and had to denitrify more in 2015 than we have ever before. So the system isn't working. It's broken. It's risking a horrible economic outcome as well as a very risky public health consequence on us. But yet the political winds still seem to believe that agriculture should be heavily subsidized and not held accountable for its pollution.
And meanwhile, these guys are making a lot of money. Am I right? I mean,
agriculture in this state is huge business. Most of farming is done by renters, not by tenant farms. This isn't, Norman Rockwell or Grant Wood.
Right.
This is a big business in this state where, again, we only have 90,000 farmers. They're multimillion-dollar operations, and we're raising feed for animals and feed for ethanol,
right,
not the kind of crops that you would see in California, as an example, or Oregon, that go, or Florida, that go directly to consumers. We're kind of a either producing ethanol or producing pork to send the Chinese middle class while we continue to degrade our environment in the process of making those things happen.
Well, this is one of my like pet peeves, is like the selling off of agricultural assets to foreign companies. But that's another topic for another day. But that's something
that
I think
that
is incredibly scary.
Hugely, and there's no romantic yeoman farmer out there. Again, there's some great CSA people and organic farmers and small scale, but the water quality in the state is driven by mega corporations and mega industrial ag, which are
far
away from small farmers.
Who are some of these big players? Are we talking like Cargill? Are we talking Smithfield?
They each have some place in the chain, if you will, of activities involved with agriculture: DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Cargill,
right,
Syngenta. Those are all going to be huge players in the entire chain of providing chemicals and raising animals and sending genetics, plant genetics, back into industrial ag. The industrial ag producers themselves are often, you know, large corporations. Koch Industries, obviously a major supplier for a number of industrial ag inputs.
For the ethanol.
So these are large, multi-billion dollar, hugely influential political players.
Oof. So since we only have about 10 minutes left, I want to hear, like, what are the solutions? What do you hope will happen with the lawsuit? What measures are these districts going to have to take? And you know, how will the state find the money to actually do the monitoring and just kind of generally enforcing these new regulations as a result of your lawsuit?
Well, ultimately, and you hit on it, our objective is to clean up the waters of Iowa through regulation of the point source polluters, just as if you have a factory or a sewage treatment plant or a municipal storm sewer system, you have to have a permit. We would want permits issued for the drainage districts, and there are about 3,000 in Iowa, so not a small task, but nonetheless still a manageable task. And we think that, again, the producers should be held accountable. There are a number of checkoff resources that are out there in the commodities world. That is every bushel of grain and every bushel of corn, soybeans, every head of cattle, every head of hogs that's produced, there's an opportunity for revenue on the producers that can certainly fund the inspection process and the compliance process, just as it does in air quality for all the permitting that's necessary to make sure that dischargers, polluters into the airs of the state or the United States are regulated. So that same kind of model certainly is transferable, we think, into the world of protecting the surface waters of the state. Ultimately, what we're trying to do through that also is internalize the cost of production. We believe that the costs are understated now when the pollution costs or the pollution remediation costs are being pushed to our consumers. The producers should have to pay for it. There's certainly technologies out there now, Katie, and those technologies will only improve, that'll provide the ability to provide real-time data. We're very concerned today, and you and I have focused a lot on nitrogen, but in a state, again, that has 21 million hogs and 3 million people, we know that there are a lot of antibiotics, as an example, coming into our watershed through livestock operation. And as the science gets better, there are going to be better regulation, better need to protect public health through different forms of regulation and different permit requirements. And, you know, our model certainly will be that the producers are going to be responsible for not only compliance, but for the process of regulating and inspecting to be able to protect against those future public health risks that are real. A lot of attention in the last few months on Flint, which was a great example of how we often take our water systems for granted, and how a political process can force decisions to be made that are ridiculously dangerous. In that situation, as I understand in talking with folks in our business, the initial decision to change from Lake Huron to Flint River was a $5 million savings. Now you're looking at billions of dollars in remediation costs.
Yeah.
That doesn't even mention the public health risk to children, obviously, that has already been, unfortunately, very much realized in the public health consequences for them. So water systems, like so many infrastructure issues that you and I face as American citizens, is an issue that we have a tendency to ignore until failure. We're not going to let this nitrate situation get any worse without stepping forward and challenging in the political, in the legal front through litigation, and ultimately, if we need to, on the political side also, that there are incredible consequences from continuing industrial agriculture without holding accountable the producers for the adverse impacts downstream.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I were living in the state of Louisiana, for example, or anywhere on the Gulf of Mexico, I'd be suing those. I'd be suing your drainage districts, too. You know
there's
what I mean?
No, you know, like, there's no question.
I mean, it's all the way down the Mississippi.
I lived in New Orleans for a number of years, Katie. There's a huge impact from what happens thousands of miles upstream from the Gulf by agricultural activities here. Iowa, Illinois, Indiana are huge contributors to killing the Gulf and the Gulf Coast. We need to take responsibilities. We're going to do everything we can from a local level to begin to make producers pay for the consequences of their downstream. But I'm confident there are other people at a macro level, as you talked about earlier, that will have a real interest in doing everything they can to better protect the environment. Climate change will be have a huge impact, obviously, on a number of things that will happen. We need to be more responsible and have less of a view that, well, if it doesn't affect me, I don't need to be concerned about it. That's why we have regulation. That's why we have national values around protecting the environment and protecting public health.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get back on point and making sure that there is appropriate regulation and appropriate compliance, and not follow this path of every regulation is bad and we can somehow deregulate and tear down a national apparatus for environmental protection and end up with a safe outcome. Because
right.
The poor will always pay disproportionately from that source of direction.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, on that note, let's talk for a second about those caucuses, because it was famously Ted Cruz, I'll go ahead and say that name, who did not kiss the ring of Big Ag in Iowa, who did not encourage or at least somehow, you know, did not make it known that he supports the ethanol mandate. But I mean, in terms of overall, you know, sort of an overall sense of the presidential campaign, do you get a sense that even on the Democratic side that there's any great attention being paid to these infrastructural issues that cities like Des Moines face in terms of, you know, just being able to manage their water pollution problems, that there is the political will to, you know, to push back against all of these lobbies that are lobbying the local legislatures to give a free pass to polluters? You know, how do you see that playing out in national politics? Do you think that that's going to be taken up to any great degree on either side of the political aisle?
Well, in Iowa, we've become accustomed at the state level, at least, to recognizing that environmental issues are never talked about by our state elective leadership, whether it's at the gubernatorial level or at the legislative level. So we've kind of fallen into the trap that not hearing environmental issues talked about is the norm. Then the presidential selection process puts us into the limelight for every 4 years. While neither party, in my view, talked much about environmental issues, certainly the Democrats have talked about infrastructure issues and the need for rebuilding America's infrastructure and the job creation and economic impact that comes out of that. But realistically, both could do better. Very pleased that our governor stepped out against Ted Cruz on the ethanol mandate issue and really made it almost a loyalty oath for Iowans to not support Ted Cruz because of his failure to support renewable fuels. And of course, Ted Cruz won here. That is certainly questionable for a number of angles, in my view, otherwise. But it certainly, I think, did something to challenge the notion that ethanol and Big Ag is this kingmaker in the state, has been for decades and will continue to be. But neither party, in my view, have talked as specifically about environmental issues as I would want them to. But realistically, we're not going to wait for the political process, as a number of local communities, whether it's Toledo or Charleston or Flint or wherever it may be, or L.A., that have local water problems. We're going to be dealing with this locally, and local issues often provide a more satisfactory response to challenges. And unfortunately, I think that's the route that we're going to need to take here, just to come up with a solution that is respectful of our customers and also respectful of meaningful environmental protection.
Sure.
But there is a federal system out there. Water does. The Mississippi River Valley goes across a lot of state lines. The idea that there should be no federal process there, the EPA should be dismantled, or the Waters of the U.S. rule needs to be rolled back is ridiculous. Somebody doesn't understand the basics of how water flows and the consequences. We're all downstream from something.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I'd love to ask you more questions, so clearly I'll just have to invite you back. When you're in the process of doing, what did you call it, a disclosure, or I know there's
discovery.
A real word for discovery, yes.
Yeah.
When do you expect your trial to actually happen?
To complicate it a little bit, we actually have two trials.
Okay.
One of them in front of a federal judge, another in front of a state judge, or a state Supreme Court, actually.
Fascinating.
On some issues. But the basic timeline is August of this year, we'll be in front of a federal judge, absent something unforeseen. So in about 8 months, 7 months, we'll be in front of a federal judge arguing our clean water claims, our permitting claims.
Yeah.
We have some state law damage issues that will probably be heard by our state Supreme Court before that. In my view, no matter which side wins in these, there'll be an appeal process that can go on for a long time. In fact, the Iowa Secretary of Agriculture and the governor's office have been very clear that they're going to appeal if we win in any way, shape, or form. So enjoy
no
a
way.
Long ride. An expensive ride is kind of the message that we've heard from industrial ag.
Sure, and they've got the
we'll
big pockets.
We'll ride it out.
Well, good for you. I mean, I will gladly continue to talk and write and otherwise publicize the cause, because I do think you're a bellwether for many, many, many states that are involved in a lot of agriculture. And what you're doing there is really a boon to citizens across the United States, because, you know, anywhere you are, like you said, you're downriver from something. So I thank you so much. I wish you the best of luck with this. And let's stay in touch.
Always a pleasure to be on Heritage Radio Network.
Well,
please,
thank you.
Call back and we'll do it again. I'd love to have a chance
I'd love it.
To talk
I'd love
to
it, especially
listeners.
As the campaign unrolls. Let's talk later this summer.
We'll do that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill. I really appreciate your time today. Take care. Good
You're
luck.
Welcome.
And thanks to my my sponsor today. And that was the International Culinary Center. Much obliged. And, of course, thanks, as always, to my wonderful engineer, Jack Inslee. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.